Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Echo e-learning page. Don't forget that Echo membership would provide you with unlimited access to a whole range of other educational courses, as well as the entire content of the Echo e-library. Please check this out at www.echo-ibd.eu.
Hello everyone, my name is Peter Irving and I'm Chair of the Education Committee, and I'm going to talk in this podcast about extraintestinal manifestations in inflammatory bowel disease. Extraintestinal manifestations in inflammatory bowel disease are common, with anything up to 50% of patients with IBD experiencing them at some point. They occur more frequently in Crohn's disease than ulcerative colitis, and their incidence increases with ongoing disease duration. If you have one extraintestinal manifestation, then you're more likely to have another. And whilst they mostly mirror disease activity, some of them can occur independently to the inflammation in the gut. Some manifestations are more common in women, so iritis and uveitis are seen more commonly in females, whilst men are more likely to experience others, such as PSC and ankylosing spondylitis. And it is possible for extraintestinal manifestations to predate the diagnosis of inflammatory bowel disease, although clearly they're normally diagnosed once the diagnosis has been made. There's a whole variety of extraintestinal manifestations that we see affecting lots of different systems in the body, including the musculoskeletal system, the eyes, the skin, the liver and biliary tree, vascular complications, and also the respiratory tract. Probably the most common of these is the musculoskeletal system, where arthropathy and arthritis are very common, with arthralgia actually being more common than true inflammation in the joints. We see both peripheral and axial arthropathy, and they occur in up to 20% of people overall, with peripheral arthropathy being particularly common in patients with colonic disease, Crohn's disease, and in women. Axial arthropathy is seen radiologically in actually many patients, even if it doesn't manifest, with up to 50% of IBD patients having radiological evidence of sacroiliitis. But true ankylosing spondylitis only really occurs in up to 10% of people. In young patients with inflammatory back pain, probably the best investigation to do is an MRI scan. When we think about peripheral arthropathy, we think of two types. Type 1 affects fewer than 5 joints, then generally large weight-bearing joints, and the inflammation tends to be associated with the disease and self-limited. Type 2, however, tends to be more joints affected, often affected symmetrically in the upper limbs, and the inflammation is often chronic. So this is the typical patient who gets inflammation in lots of joints in the hand, for example. Axial arthropathy should probably be managed jointly with rheumatologists, and in the short term, non-steroidals can be helpful, although they can occasionally cause a flare of the disease, in which case we tend to use COX-2 inhibitors preferentially. Physiotherapy is useful, but really the only drug that makes any difference to the long-term outcome is anti-TNF therapy. Peripheral arthropathy should respond in some cases to treating the underlying gut disorder, but again may require short-term treatment with non-steroidal anti-inflammatories or perhaps local steroid injection. Systemic steroids, use of disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs such as sulfasalazine and methotrexate can also be useful, but again anti-TNF has probably changed the landscape here. The other musculoskeletal thing that we think about is inflammation causing osteopenia and osteoporosis, and that's particularly common, of course, in smokers and people with extensive steroid exposure, so we really ought to think about those patients as well. Let's move on to eye disease, which occurs in something like 5 to 10% of patients. We see ocular inflammation, such as episcleritis and scleritis, and intraocular inflammation, such as uveitis. And since some ocular manifestations can threaten sight, there should be joint management with ophthalmologists if there's any question over the diagnosis. Episcleritis tends to mirror disease activity. It can be relatively painless, causing perhaps only itching and burning, and it's not generally sight-threatening. Treating the underlying disease is helpful, as are topical non-steroidals and steroids. When we think about uveitis, this is often not disease activity related. An anterior uveitis can be treated with steroids and cycloplegics. Sometimes, however, immunomodulators and anti-TNF are used. Scleritis is painful, it causes visual disturbance, and it can threaten sight. So again, this needs to be managed aggressively in association with ophthalmologists. So what about the skin? Again, a common place for extra-intestinal manifestations. Probably the most well-known of these are erythema nodosum, which can occur in anything between 5 and 10% of patients, and pyoderma gangrenosum, which occurs in fewer patients, probably only up to 2%. We do also, of course, see manifestations related to drugs, but we won't cover those today. Erythema nodosum classically occurs on the lower limbs and causes red, painful lesions measuring about 1 to 5 centimetres. Again, it's usually associated with disease activity, although I have seen it, for example, in association with azathioprine use. A paniculitis is seen on biopsy, although the findings are normally fairly obvious, so biopsy is not normally necessary. And the disease tends to respond when we treat the active underlying inflammation. Pyoderma gangrenosum can be a devastating disease, and it can occur anywhere on the body, although it mostly occurs on the shins or in peristomal areas in association with injury to the skin. We see initially papules or pustules that can lead to necrosis with a rapidly progressive and painful movement through to really quite large and nasty ulcers. It's seen more commonly in ulcerative colitis than Crohn's disease, and it can either mirror or be independent of disease activity. Steroids, systemic or topical treatment with calcineurin inhibitors are effective, but again, anti-TNF has revolutionised the management of this nasty condition. The only other condition I'll mention is another neutrophilic dermatosis, which is called Sweet syndrome. This can be mistaken for other conditions, including pyoderma, and it tends to occur on the upper body, the face and the neck, with painful nodules or papules. It can be associated with fever. It tends to be a little bit more common in women and people with colonic involvement of their inflammatory bowel disease. And again, often responds to treatment with steroids or immunomodulators. It's been reported to respond to anti-TNF therapy as well, although there are in fact case reports of it being caused by anti-TNF therapy. Cardiovascular manifestations of inflammatory bowel disease are not really thought of as much as extra-intestinal manifestations, but of course they do coexist. Cerebrovascular and cardiovascular disease are probably increased in patients with inflammatory bowel disease, and of course we see problems with other vessels causing, for example, mesenteric ischemia. There's lots of confounders, but potentially, such as smoking and Crohn's disease, and there are differing results in meta-analyses. But I think it's becoming increasingly clear that chronic inflammation is atherogenic. One area, however, where there's no doubt is in terms of thromboembolic disease. We know that active disease is associated with a coagulopathy. Pulmonary embolism and DVT are about 2 or 3 times more likely in patients with inflammatory bowel disease and are associated with an increased risk of mortality. So patients who have active disease tend to have thrombocytosis, their platelets are activated, they're often dehydrated and immobile and more likely to undergo surgery. And so, of course, those patients are at increased risk of thromboembolic disease. Hepatobiliary disease is also relatively common, and the most worrying of these is primary sclerosing cholangitis. Abnormal LFTs are common in patients with inflammatory bowel disease, but PSC probably only occurs in about 4% of IBD patients. Unfortunately, it's often asymptomatic, so the diagnosis can be missed. And by the time symptoms such as sepsis, pain, pruritus, and malaise develop, we're often seeing patients with advanced disease. MRCP is a useful screening test, and biopsy can also help to clinch the diagnosis, although it's also worth considering other diagnoses such as IgG4-related disease and autoimmune hepatitis. Importantly, patients with PSC should have surveillance for colorectal cancer on a yearly basis. Management of the disease itself is not particularly effective, and whilst ursodeoxycholic acid improves liver function tests, it doesn't alter the outcome. Strictures may require endoscopic management, and unfortunately, cholangiocarcinoma needs to be considered in such cases. Liver transplant is occasionally helpful, even in the context of cholangiocarcinoma if it's early, but of course, this has a poor prognosis associated with it overall. Let's move on to respiratory manifestations. I think these are some of the most underdiagnosed extra intestinal manifestations of inflammatory bowel disease, and we can in fact see inflammation occurring in all parts of the airways, although most commonly large airways are affected. Disease, interestingly, may be exacerbated after colectomy, and we also occasionally see interstitial lung disease. It's also important to think of potential drug causes, so rarely 5-ASA can cause pneumonitis, and methotrexate is known to cause fibrosis in the lungs, although we see this more commonly in patients with rheumatology-related conditions. In general, it tends to respond to steroid treatment, and certainly involvement of a respiratory specialist can be useful. So I think we'll finish there. I'm going to summarise by saying that extraintestinal manifestations are common. Remember that they can occasionally present before the diagnosis of inflammatory bowel disease. Many of them mirror disease activity, although they don't all do that. And it's important to remember they can be associated with considerable morbidity and mortality. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Please come back and listen to some others.